this show, we meet people who have carved out success by their own definition. I'm David Cadvey, best-selling author and entrepreneur. We have a record to celebrate with last week's episode, The Behavioral Revolution, Not the Information Revolution. We had a record number of downloads for a single day. We had 1,308 downloads on that day, and this beat our previous record of 1,275, which we hit way back in January with the interview of neuroscientist John Cuenos. And you may remember a few weeks ago, we passed the 50,000 download mark. Well, we're getting pretty close to the 60,000 download mark now. We'll probably hit it with not this week's episode, but next week's episode. The interview with Jason Fried continues to be the most popular, so I've been working to make it more accessible. There is a full transcript available. There is a YouTube version of it. And I've even broken it up into a YouTube playlist full of sound bites, so you can share your favorite parts of the show on Twitter or Facebook. You can find a link to that in the show notes. And I'm a little embarrassed. I had completely forgotten that there are separate iTunes stores outside of the U.S., which is ironic because I'm outside the view of the U.S. And people have been rating and reviewing the show on the iTunes stores in places like Canada, Mexico, and the UK, and I had no idea, but I just happened to discover them recently. So thank you to UDX, Matt R. Lacey, David Ralph UK, which I'm pretty sure that's the David Ralph from the Join Up Dots podcast, Jonathan A. Lyon, Filio Rocks, and everyone all over the world who has been reviewing, subscribing, and sharing. And we have a new sponsor. You've met the evil genius behind this company on a previous episode, and you've heard me rave about the product. Pavlok is a wristband that shocks you. It sounds totally crazy, but it's extremely effective at breaking bad habits. I used it to cure my Facebook addiction, which I've written about on Medium, and which I talked about on the show with Manish Sethi, the creator of Pavlok. And now you can get $50 off of a Pavlok wristband with the new Love Your Work discount. Just go to cadvey.net/Pavlok. That's P as in Paul, A, V as in Victor, L-O-K. That's cadvey.net/Pavlok for $50 off. If you buy a wristband there, you will be supporting the show. And do you have a website? If you do, you should be using SumoMe. If you have a little sign up for my newsletter thing off to the side, you are definitely missing out on a ton of email signups. You could raise your signup rate something like, from what I've seen, something like 40x by using SumoMe's welcome mat. And they have a ton of tools for growing your list and growing your traffic, including really attractive social media share buttons that I use on all my websites. And you've already seen SumoMe all over the place. It's used by Airbnb, Tim Ferriss, Pat Flynn, Wait But Why, and 200,000 other websites. Did I say 200,000? I think I did already. Anyway, just go to cadvey.net/SumoMe, that's all one word, SumoMe, to get SumoMe completely free. It's really easy to install, and it gives you instant access to more than a dozen tools to grow your website and grow your traffic. That's cadvey.net/SumoMe, all one word. You'll be supporting the show. Our guest today has made a living traveling around eating her favorite foods. Jodi Ettenberg used to be a lawyer. She took a year off to travel 8 years ago and never went back. Her blog, Legal Nomads, won a Lowell Thomas Award for Best Travel Blog and has been featured in the New York Times, National Geographic, BBC Travel, CNN, and many more places. Legal Nomads is full of tips on packing, planning, and budgeting for travel, as well as beautiful hand-drawn typographic food maps and t-shirts, and guides and translation cards for eating gluten-free while traveling. Jodi has written a book called The Food Traveler's Handbook, which shows you how to find cheap, safe, and delicious food anywhere in the world. This interview is full of wisdom on the benefits and challenges that come with a life of travel. Jodi is really insightful when it comes to recognizing how travel relates to all of human experience. And I think that if you're someone who has ever thought about making a big change like Jodi did, or if you've ever struggled to be more minimal and have less stuff, then you'll find this conversation especially inspiring and enlightening. You may notice that there are a ton of book recommendations in this interview. There are links in the show notes for all the books Jodi mentions. And remember, if you buy books those books through those links in the show notes, you'll be supporting the show. Here's the interview. I'm here with Jody Ettenberg of Legal Nomads. And Jody, I heard that you eat soup for a living. Is that true?
That is what I tell people. Yes, that is true. Also, I do definitely consume a lot of soup and have happily built a business around the business of doing so.
So is that what you usually tell people that you do, is that you eat soup? Or, I mean, it's a tough question to answer sometimes.
I tell people that I write about the history of food, usually, but sometimes when I'm in a crowd of people where everyone's got a very conventional career, I definitely have been known to say I eat soup for a living, partly because it's pithy and partly because it's accurate and definitely stands out a bit when people want to understand what I do. It leads to the follow-up questions that would explain what I do in a more thorough way than just saying I write about the history of food.
Right. And the Legal Nomads aspect might be a little confusing to some people. Can you provide background on that?
Sure. Yeah, I joke that I'm 8 years in on that site, and it's a little late to think about branding. But I started the site because I was a lawyer for 5 years, and I was expecting to take a 1 year sabbatical and write about the stories from the travels to share with my family, my colleagues, my clients that I was working with as a lawyer. And I was nomadic for what I thought would be a year. There were two of us, another lawyer as well. We set out together, and about 2.5 months in, she didn't really enjoy writing. I figured that I liked it a lot more than I thought I would. And what happened is I kept on with the site and just kept the name. Again, just thinking it would be for family and friends. And at this point, I'm definitely firmly ensconced in the branding. But the only part of the site that has to do with legal work at this point is that I have an interview series for lawyers who have also quit the profession of law, who are doing interesting things. And I ask the same questions so that they get an ability to talk to people about, you know, what their trajectory was and help a profession that is not always the happiest of people maybe think about next steps for them also. But the bulk of the work I do is actually food related, which you're right, you wouldn't necessarily know from the name. And it has evolved into that really last 8 years. Food wasn't what I talked about at the beginning of my travels, but it's certainly become my primary obsession now.
Yeah, and I actually first came across your work because you have some really good tips and actually translation cards and stuff for gluten-free travel. And there was just really useful information on there. So if it was a site initially to share things with friends, how did it end up becoming full of useful information?
Well, I have celiac disease and I was diagnosed way before I started traveling. I didn't think to write about it, to be honest, because it was supposed to be a narrative site for the people who knew me. You know, they know I have the disease, but it wasn't the focus. And when people met me or when they wrote me, I have this eating restriction, you know, you may not understand, but this is what I'm dealing with. Do you know of any resources? And I would be like, actually, I can help. Because I have a disease too that helps me help people who have the same problem. And so I think, you know, the same way that a lot of people end up putting up a page on their site for questions they receive often from readers, I started basically putting up the information. When I received a question, and you know, more than three times, I would put up something on the site that related to it, partly because I would then forward people along to that page instead of having to type out an email, and partly because I figured if people are asking, there's got to be, you know, people who might be too shy to ask, and that might help them too. So, you know, I do some speaking also about storytelling and narrative, and in an online world, I think both the practical posts and the storytelling are really important in establishing yourself as an authority, because, you know, the storytelling you write for the world, in a sense, you're sharing something that you hope changes people's perspectives about a place or people or their desire to learn and dig and understand. And then the practical stuff is, like you said, it helps people who have some sort of restriction or fear or things like that, gives them some advice. I think taken together, it's a really thorough way to try and help. And it just progressed as the site did. You know, I didn't quit my job as a lawyer to be a travel and food writer. I quit to take a sabbatical. And so it wasn't for a while that I thought about it as a business or a new career. And once I shifted focus and thought, okay, this is something that's developing into something I'm really excited about doing, drawing on things that I'm passionate about that I never expected to build a business out of, it allowed me to also take a step back and say, okay, like strategically, what are the pain points that people can be finding on my site answers to, but also that I'm uniquely positioned to help with. And for me, that was talking about, you know, street food and how important it is to learn about a place by sitting there and understanding and really jiving with the culture, but also this, you know, restriction of having celiac disease and the anxiety that comes with that, not really knowing if people are telling you the truth necessarily about what you're about to eat.
Do you remember the day or a specific time when you realized, oh, this could actually be a business?
I think what happened was I was in Thailand in 2010, and I joked about this actually in the talk I gave about storytelling recently, because I went to Myanmar for about 7 weeks and my friends were like, we're moving you to WordPress.org. I was on Blogspot for those first 2 years and I was like, I love my site. It's so pretty.
That's
and
of course, a tough migration, by the way.
I know. And it was like black background and white text. It just was, it's pretty horrific to look at what it was that I thought was, you know, perfect at the time. But my friends were having none of it. And they basically bullied me onto WordPress, which I'm very grateful for. And at the same time, what happened is CNN Go, which is now part of CNN Travel, reached out to me in Bangkok and said, we've seen some of your posts. Would you be interested in working as one of our freelancers, basically, as a stringer to just be on their list of database people who could write and send photos. And I was like, really? Me? Okay. And, you know, that sort of began the process of thinking about it. I tend to turn down a lot of the freelance work that I get offered because I like to focus on my site and the projects there, like the translation cards you're talking about. But it was this pitch that came through to me directly without me having to pitch that made me think, wait a second, if people find that there's some resonance there with my writing that go beyond friends and family. And at that point, the site did get comments from people who I remember being really, who are these people who are finding mm-hmm. my site? When, you know, I was truly just writing to share my experiences with people who knew me. It just sort of snowballed from there. And I began trying to take on public speaking roles because it was something that made me really nervous. I won most easily embarrassed in high school. You know, it was the idea of getting on stage was just like, oh, hell no. I threw up before pretty much every speech I gave for the first year. Wow. Like, that's how bad it was.
That's my worst nightmare.
Yeah, it was not, you know, starting with Chris Guillebeau, who actually was the reason I started speaking. He asked me to help with his WDS conference, the first one he did. Did not specify what that meant. And I was like, sure, Chris, whatever you need. I had met him at one of his meetups in Bangkok. And he put me as a keynote speaker without asking. He just put it on his page. And I was like, what the hell?
I went to get up there and give a speech to 1,000 people or how many?
500 was the first one. Wow. For my first ever speech, people would write and were like, how did this happen? Congratulations. And I was like, please hold. Dear Chris, what are you doing? And he said, you know, look, if I had asked you, I know you would have said no, and now you can't. People are excited to hear you speak, so you're going to have to get up there. And, you know, it was a valuable thing. I tortured myself before I got up, but public speaking has also become an important arm of the work that I do. And a really interesting way, I think. I know a lot of your guests have done talks as well, either TED Talks or otherwise. You know, it's a really fascinating way to tell a story, create empathy, get in front of people with a message that is very different than the way they would perceive that in writing.
Right. And so it was CNN that initially got in contact with you, right? Do you remember the nature of what work it was they saw and what it was about that then to contact? Do you have any insight into that?
Sure. I think what happened is the same that's happened since, to be honest. You know, people talk about Twitter as a social media of all the social media, the medium that is sort of tanking at the moment and changing focus and pivoting in a way that's sort of losing its core. But I think that journalists use Twitter differently than normal humans. And I had always used it the way journalists did, because to me, it was such a great way to share interesting information. When I was a lawyer, I used to send out a link of the day email because I was a little bored negotiating contracts. And, you know, when I would be gathering things I read during the day and send it out, and it had a big list at the end of when I quit my job. Twitter to me was a way to share that kind of information in real time. And so while I think a lot of people in the travel world, travel blogging specifically, used Twitter kind of as a community megaphone for each other's work, I have to say sometimes without even reading it, I decided I would just use it to share stuff that was interesting. And at the beginning, you know, my people would say, well, why are you tweeting about astronomy? You're a travel blogger. And I was like, well, because I think space is awesome. Like, what kind of question is that? But the journalists who reached out from CNN were people who followed me on Twitter. I was in Bangkok during the coup in 2010 and the protests that then turned quite violent, as they sometimes do in Bangkok. And and they had seen what I was putting out there in terms of information, and then it led them to my site, and I think it went from there. So recently, for example, I wrote a piece about Vipassana meditation. I had taken a 10-day retreat.
Just read that, course. Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you for reading. And a woman who is an editor at The Guardian reached out and said, hey, I follow you on Twitter. I like that you share links that are interesting. I saw your piece. Would you like to cut it in half? I was like, oh, God. And repost it on The Guardian for pay in sort of a different way, because obviously the one on my site is part of the living ecosystem of the site. A lot of my readers, you know, have some information predating it that I had to then build into the new one. And that was another example of what's happened over the years. I think most of the press and a lot of the growth of the brand itself and what Legal Nomads has stood for has come from, you know, interacting with journalists by hopefully adding value to their conversations and using Twitter as a way to share information that is interesting and not just, you know, self-promotional.
And just in case people are wondering, can you share some of the different ways that makes money?
Sure. I don't monetize the base site with advertising or sponsored content. Like I don't take
press
trips.
There's no ads on there. Yeah, I know.
No ads. I take maybe one press trip a year, and that's about it. And it's pretty rare. It's usually when the tourism board reaches out and says, like, we know you love food. We have also alpacas, which we know you love. Like, come to our city and we will set you up. And I'll, you know, agree to do it, providing specific deliverables. But the only other content I've got on the site that is not me paying for my way and then writing about it is that I'm a brand ambassador for G Adventures. And I have been for 5 years. Other than that, all the work that I do is sort of using the site as a platform. So I've built hand-drawn maps of food that are one of a kind. I work with an artist. We're building 10 countries in all. And those are sold in posters and t-shirt form. And now I'm going to be doing tote bags as well. That e-commerce store came out of the site as well. It's like a subdomain of Legal Nomads. I do a lot of consulting work for branding as well, for travel companies looking to position themselves and sort of hone in on their messaging online. I wrote a book a few years ago about food and travel. And on the site itself, there are affiliate links for Amazon for the products that I use or books I've read. Is really the way the site otherwise is unmonetized.
So it sounds like you really just kind of explored what was interesting to you and shared what was helpful and then doubled down on the things that worked. And you have these posters. Does that sound accurate?
Yeah, I think what happened is that for me, the reason the business is so interesting is that it allows me to learn as much as I can every day. You know, that is what being a lawyer didn't give me. I didn't burn out as a lawyer and quit. As I said, I took a sabbatical thinking I would go back to being a lawyer. But when I found myself sort of in this burgeoning business that truly gave me this opportunity to take something I loved, which is food, and use it to soak up as much information as I could, and then hopefully change people's perspective. It made me feel like I was providing more value than I was as a lawyer, but it also, you know, gave me the hit of constant curiosity and learning as well. And that, I think, is an amazing thing. You know, the flexibility, those things are things I chose to build in, but the fact that the business itself is built on a foundation of soaking in information is something I'm really grateful for that I was able to do, because it's definitely the foundation of why I love it the most. I think, you know, the products I put out and things like that, these translation cards I'm doing for celiacs, which are basically, you know, really deeply built translation cards, the ones that are often out there, which I'm super grateful for. There's some great sites out there like celiac.com and Celiac Travel that try and provide, you know, free cards for people to use. They're very basic, like, I can't eat wheat, barley, and rye. It will get me very sick. Please don't feed me these things. The problem is, as you probably know, in developing countries especially, people just don't know what has wheat, barley, and rye.
Yeah.
Not at all. And not even developing countries. Like New Zealand, mayonnaise has wheat, which I found out the hard way. At a gluten-free place, they were like, oh yeah, we did put mayonnaise. I was like, guys, this is no joke, you know? And I was sick for 3 days, you know, couldn't bend my hands in the morning. It's not an allergy, it's an autoimmune issue. So your immune system is just a mess for a while. So these cards basically are, I write them out in English doing research. I hired another celiac to help me. And we're basically putting together like these super detailed cards and then paying for translations. In some cases, my readers have mother tongue languages that are not English and they volunteer to crowdsource the translations. And I'm putting them up one by one on the site. Eventually, that would be an app as well, like a very simple offline app. But the goal is, okay, this is something that is a legitimate pain point. as you said, you know, I doubled down on it because it doesn't exist. Those food maps came about because I wanted to buy a food map for someone who was starting a restaurant. And I was like, I really love to put like the map of Vietnam and all the foods around it. Like, mm-hmm. it's just such an amazing shape as a country. And I was like, oh, it doesn't exist. And I can't draw. I'm legitimately artistically challenged. So a woman I've worked with in the past, I reached out and I drew her. She looked at my drawing and was like, oh, yes, I see why you're hiring me. And she built it for me. And we, you know, put together a contract for her to do 10 countries and all. So it all has stemmed out of these weird octopus arms of the main site. But it's truly just, oh, this doesn't exist. And the marketplace needs it. I'm gonna put it out.
Yeah, I think this is great. You're following your curiosity. You are just living your own experiences and sharing the challenges you meet along the way. And in doing so, the result is that you're probably having a bigger impact than if you were still a lawyer. I mean, if you were, you know, somebody else is probably doing what you used to do in place of you, and now you're doing something that really only you can.
Right. I made the joke as a lawyer that we're all like fungible billing units. You know, there's really nothing truly distinctive about you as a human that makes you good at your job as a lawyer. And there are definitely, you know, great negotiators and people who are strategic and, you know, they make partner and bring in business because of their personalities. But, you know, there's this whole idea of what is the story that you are uniquely positioned to tell? You know, what the culmination of your life experiences led you to where you are? What is it that you can do that other people can't? And for me, I'm like a short woman who travels the world often alone, who has celiac disease, who's obsessed with street food. Like the Venn diagram of all those things.
It's a lot of challenges there.
It's a lot of challenges, but it's also a lot of people who are afraid, who perhaps want to do something similar, but are scared to do so. And like, if I can put out information and then leverage that information in a way that makes people want to buy something, not because I trick them, but because they find what I do valuable enough that they want to support it, and they have, then I feel like I'm doing something right.
Great. Let's circle back to when you decided to take this sabbatical.
Yes.
What was going on in your mind at that time?
So I should add a few things. The first is that I'm Canadian, which I mention because tuition in Canada for law school is not what tuition in the States for law school is. And I went to McGill, which is a great school, and I was a Quebec resident. It's a Quebec school. So my tuition was very, very low, $1,600 Canadian at a time when the dollar was not doing that well. So I paid that off pretty quickly. There is no issue with...
It's an important component of the story, I guess.
And I mention it in every interview I do, or try to, you know, because I think it's really unfortunate how much information is out there on the internet that is supposed to be inspirational, that leaves out like key details about that person's leverage and ability to do this. People are like, oh, well, you saved up money as a lawyer, so you don't really understand the plight of starting from nothing. And I was like, listen, you know, everyone has choices to make, and I decided to walk away from a very lucrative profession to do this. But yes, I always say, my tuition was low enough that I was not walking away also with staggering debt. I think it's really important to make that distinction. The other thing is I went to law school at 18, which is not usually possible in Canada or the States. And someone bet me when applications were due that I couldn't get in. That was why I applied. So that's important because it wasn't like I was aching to be a lawyer my whole life and then just had sort of like mental breakdown. I applied on a whim. I got in. And I got some funding to go to McGill, and the tuition was reasonable. I was recruited to New York City by a firm, and I was like, you know, I had always wanted to go to Siberia because I had seen a documentary about the Trans-Siberian trains, and I had done a project on Lake Baikal as a kid, and it's just taken on this sort of mythical, like, I must get to Siberia. And so as a lawyer in New York, I, you know, didn't buy $1,000 shoes. I saved up money thinking, okay, that's a plane ticket somewhere fun. So the mentality as I started was already a bit, you know, distanced from a lot of what my colleagues were thinking. A lot of them were saving for things like houses and for much more traditional things. But for me, it was, I'd always wanted to get to that place. It took on this idea of I'm going to do a 1 year around the world trip. And then this woman, Jess, that I started with, she was my opposing counsel on a deal that we negotiated. And I went for dinner with her after the deal closed. I was like, hey, so I'm thinking of quitting my job and traveling. You know, a around the world. She's like, yeah, I was thinking of that too. I was like, let's go together. And so we built this site, Legal Nomads. Our slogan used to be Two Lawyers, One World, which was a terrible two girls, one cup joke. And we just thought, this is going to be our blog and we're going to share our 1 year trip and then go back to being a lawyer. So she did exactly that. She, after 2.5 months, as I said, she wasn't interested in writing anymore. And so she stopped writing on the site and sent out emails. Occasionally she's put up posts that year, but then she went back to being a lawyer. She worked for a great company that was sold to Google. She's now working in San Francisco as a lawyer. She stuck to the plan, but I did not. And, you know, she called it very early on. She was like, you're 100% not going back. And I was like, no, this is a 1 year trip and I'm going to go back. And then what happened is, you know, my budget stretched a lot further and I was like, maybe I'll take another year and see what happens. And then in 2010, I got this email from CNN and thought, maybe I won't go back. And she's like, I called that.
The fork in the road. So I imagine you had thought about it before that dinner conversation.
About traveling? Yeah, no, yeah. I was already planning to leave, you know, after the new year in the year following our dinner. Mm-hmm. I had planned out. I basically wanted to save enough that was comfortable to travel for a year. I had budgeted more than I needed, but I didn't know that at the time, and wanted to have enough as a buffer that when I came back, I wanted to refocus on a different area of the law. I didn't want to go back to a private law firm and do private law. I was thinking of doing microfinance work or something more in an advocacy context. And so I thought I would need some readjustment. I had read about reverse culture shock. I basically wanted a bit of a buffer. And because I was working, you know, in New York, and I just pushed it off for an extra year and saved up more in order to give myself that freedom when I came back.
And did you have much resistance or naysayers when you decided that you were going to take this year off?
Oh, yes. I mean, I think anybody who leaves an expectation of specific behavior has negativity that comes at them. You know, I was not following the plan I was supposed to follow, right? I was supposed to be up in partner in a few years. I was supposed to have been really happy with my life in New York. And I remember having a conversation with someone and I was like, look, every day that I stay in New York working as a lawyer makes me feel like it's one day closer to dying as a boring person. And they were like, well, that is a hyperbolistic statement if I've ever heard one. And I was like, but I legitimately believe it. I mean, and that is in no way, shape or form a judgment on other people who do that. I only can tell my story. That's why there's no post on my site that says, I quit my job and you should too. It says, here's my story. I can only share how I feel. And for me, I felt almost strangled by the work I was doing. I mean, I never wanted to be a lawyer, right? So it wasn't as though I had this idea that it would be the epitome of excellence when I took that job. It was just a step towards something different. I just did not know what that was. And I think the partners I worked with were like, you're ruining your life. Not all of them. Some were very supportive and some I still hang out with and see when I go back to New York to visit. But I think it takes a really strong person to tell someone doing something really different from their life that it's worthwhile, because it's hard not to let that person's choices undermine in some subconscious way what you've done. And so it doesn't surprise me that that was the way that it was perceived, especially in a very, you know, specifically often materialistic city like New York and in a profession that's very lockstep, like being a lawyer. I tell people, because I often talk to lawyers who want to quit, and I don't do coaching work I don't hang a shingle about it, but I have done some consulting work for people in the past because they are legitimately struggling with their feelings of inadequacy and leaving regardless of what they plan to do. And I'm always like, listen, you need to have just soundbite responses about how you're going to handle the questions that will arise, figure out what your worst case scenario is and make that your answer. Like I always said, look, I'm going to keep my admission as a lawyer. I'm not canceling my bar admission, partly because I never want to take the bar again in my life, but also because, you know, who knows? You don't know where life leads you. What if there's some crazy crisis in my family and I need to go back and earn money that way quickly? I want to be able to have that skill set. No one can take that skill set away from me. Like, figure out what the skills that you have that you cannot have someone take away from you and start building that out as, like, that's your worst case scenario.
Yeah, and I know I've met lawyers before, who maybe years ago, they said that they kind of had the path that had initially talked about where, oh, they're going to quit doing the corporate lawyer thing, and then they're going to doing some sort of law that's a little closer to their heart or something like that. And then years years go by and you hear them say, well, I'm almost going to make partner, and they're increasingly spending more and more money, and they have bigger loans than you did. And then it just kind of never happens. And yeah, I agree, you know, not to judge somebody's choices, but when you see somebody who truly wants to or should be doing something different and they don't do it, it's sad to me.
It is. It's a wasted, yeah. In a way, it's a wasted opportunity to make a bigger difference, I think. But, you know, there's a lot of fear, and rightfully so. I don't begrudge anyone who has, you know, a family and a mortgage and all these obligations that they have chosen to build into their lives, right? All of this is a choice. I chose to walk away from certainty toward more uncertainty, and that's something I struggle with, something we all struggle with. You know, it's not very comforting to not necessarily know how you're going to sustain yourself going forward. Even if you've built something sustainable now, who knows what's happening? But I think, you know, there are oftentimes excuses that are made. There are people who will say, I can't cut down my spending. I can't do this. And the reality is often they can. It's just they're afraid of judgment from their friends. They're afraid of feeling like they're not providing for their families. They're afraid of a lot. And I understand those fears. It's certainly not easy, especially if you're in a culture that is sort of obsessed with things. But we need so much less than we think we do. You know, I'm not a hyper minimalist. I don't travel carry on only. I don't travel with like 8 suitcases either. I have a bag and it's like a reasonable size. But my point is, like, I'm not one of those people who is, you know, writing continuously about minimalist travel. But I also think I don't have much, you know, and I don't miss having much. I think you need a lot less than you do, but it's really, really hard to get around that concept when your whole life you're told otherwise, like not just advertising, but people sort of sustaining that lifestyle because it makes them feel better about their own purchasing choices also. You don't need the nicer car, I promise.
Mm-hmm. And did you experience internally any of these fears or any resistance that might have prevented you taking?
I definitely, the fear that consumed me was not fear about stuff like that. It was more my personal safety. I was worried about like arriving in a place late at night and not knowing where to go and feeling very vulnerable in that way, or, you know, worried about it as a woman who, like I said, I'm not the most intimidating to look at. Things like that, where it was a personal safety issue that really worried me before I left that kept me up at night. Things like what would I do after were certainly a big concern, but I think they loomed smaller. Like what loomed large was the personal safety issue. Mm-hmm. And I certainly still do think about it and wonder about where it's all going to go. But if anything along these last 8 years of doing what I do now has taught me, it's that, you know, if you point yourself in the direction of the things you're prepared to really work hard at and are comfortable throwing in a lot of effort and learning, the opportunities that come your way are probably not what you expect. And you just need to be flexible enough to see them and want to take them, because if you're so focused on specific end goals, I find you actually don't see the opportunities that are in front of you, and that's the biggest problem. So, you know, even the people who necessarily change their lifestyle, sometimes I've seen this sort of dogmatic obsession with end goals that actually detracts from what the most beautiful thing about this lifestyle is, which is you built a flexible life so that you can do things that bring you joy, but also that are different than you ever expected them to be.
So it's interesting. It didn't sound like concerns about your career or concern or letting go of materialism or material things was much of a challenge.
No, is that accurate? I do. I actually, no one's ever asked that question, but I actually wonder why that is. I mean, I've never been obsessed with things. I definitely, you know, I bought some nice shoes when I was in New York. I had suits, mm-hmm. You know, I was working, I had to look respectable, but I still try to look respectable now, despite not working at a law firm anymore. Yeah, I don't think the stuff was anything I ever cared about. My family never placed that much value on stuff. We're always very, very rigid about taking care of the things you had. Like, it's important to treat, if you invest in something, you treat it with respect, even if it's an inanimate object. You know, you're not flippant about the things you buy. But this sort of like clamoring for more mentality was just not what my family, what my upbringing was. You know, it was modest. And I think that despite that, it's never like I saw things as the apex of what life is about. So it just wasn't that much of a concern. I definitely found it a bit, you know, it's tough sometimes. It's intimidating when you're in a culture that is materialistic, when you're not doing those things. You know, sure, I felt feelings of inadequacy when I was like, oh, should I be buying more suits, or should I be dressing in a certain way, or, you know, being seen in certain places when people make you feel like you are supposed to be doing those things. But that doesn't go away no matter what you do. I think it's really a personal litmus about where you feel comfortable. And if you can justify to yourself those things that you decide to spend on or do and invest in, you know, I think that's what really matters in the end.
Do you remember any specific examples or conversations about how those values might have been
From my childhood, you mean?
Yeah. You mentioned that your family kind of wasn't materialistic in that way. Was there anything about that was different from other people around you?
I don't think it was different from people around me. You know, I went to a public school.
You were in Canada.
You Canadians.
Different.
You and your lack of...
You weren't in the United States where we're just...
I was, no. You know, I went to a public school. I think maybe had my parents been wealthier and sent me to private schools or... I don't know what that would have looked like, but I grew up, you know, I went to a public school. I went to a university where every university in Canada is a state school in that, you know, it's all subsidized. There's not the kind of tranches of private and public, and mm-hmm. people don't use it as much. At least when I was growing up, I can't speak to now. I remember going to New York and a colleague was like, oh, what school did you go to? And I was like, look, dude, like every school is in state school in Canada. It really doesn't matter. And I actually really don't care where you went to school either. I think that it's just a different mentality that these are kind of fundamental things that your education, your healthcare, those things are important for starting you out on the right foot in life. But, you know, it kind of changes the way that you perceive what you need, perhaps. I certainly haven't done any like Canadian-American analyses of what that might be. There are certainly plenty of people in Canada who are hyper ambitious when it comes to material stuff, too. But in my case, it just wasn't, you know, my family, we took road trips, we did skiing trips. My parents are split and I have four parents, they both remarried, have very different mentalities when it comes to things and what life's about and the styles of travel. But I think, you know, overall, all four of them were very much like, if you spend your money on something because you want to and you earned your money yourself, like money was always something you weren't given, it was something you had to earn. And I think that gave me a good value system for understanding that it bought a certain amount of freedom and comfort, but that it wasn't everything you needed in life.
And as you mentioned, sometimes your surroundings can have an influence on you. Was there any particular time you first realized, oh, wait a minute, my values are a little bit different than my surroundings, and I should hold on to and keep those in mind when my surroundings are trying to push me in a different direction?
I think I've felt that way for a really long time because I went to law school so young. You know, I was already this weirdo who was a lot younger than everyone else. There were a few of us that were thrown in with everyone. You know, it wasn't like a pre-law program. They just dumped us in with all the normal aged people. And people were very resentful of the fact, some were very resentful of the fact that, you know, we came in that young. Someone my first day of school told me I didn't deserve to be there and I should go back to high school where I belong. And I've always looked really young. It's certainly been, you know, difficult as a lawyer sometimes too, where my clients were like, are you my lawyer's daughter? I was like, no, I'm your lawyer. But thanks a lot. That's awesome.
I love the story about your other lawyer friend saying, oh, I called it a long time ago, or she called it. Were there any other clues that you later discovered that maybe you should have picked up on earlier?
It's like the post-relationship question. Like, where were the red flags that you missed?
Okay, yeah.
I guess these are white flags. I think what she saw was what other people saw. You know, my mom was very much like, Jody, you know, your energy is not being used effectively as a lawyer. And that was a very subtle way of saying what I think is accurate, which is that there was no resonance and joy in what I did. But I'm a perfectionist, and so I wanted to do a good job. You know, my clients and I still have good relationships. They still, you know, I put up my 8 years of travel post, and several of the responses were clients that I worked with back in New York, which makes me feel great, you know. Despite them knowing I didn't really want to be doing this, I still did an okay enough job that they found my work useful. And we got along as people. I think what Jess saw was just the difference, I guess, in how I was soaking in the information. She was very you know, excited about travel and interacted with her surroundings in a similar way. But I think the way that I internalized my input was like I was adding it to this database of experiences that was then going to be used for something else. And I saw it as, okay, I've gotten travel experience. I'll come back and I'll do work in, you know, the public sector, or these experiences will help inform me being able to help more people as a lawyer. And she was like, you're resonating so highly with what you're taking in as you travel that I just don't see that being enough for you either. Yeah.
It's almost as if you were a lawyer, you would have had a cog of a certain shape. And I mean, not to denigrate the whole thing too much, but you know, you would have a cog of a certain shape and that would fit in the gear and it would have to keep being that shape.
Right.
And as you were traveling, your cog was turning into all sorts of different shapes that weren't going to fit in with some other gear.
Yeah. And, you know, in that post I just put up about 8 years of travel, I say, you know, people ask me when is enough for this strange life that you've built. And I was like, it's a very binary way of looking at the human experience because, you know, for me, it isn't that, okay, I've reached peak whatever I'm doing and now I'm going to go back to doing what everyone expects. It's, this has turned into something that is what I do. And it is weird. It's, you know, not what everyone else does, but this idea that like eventually I've hit peak experience and then I'll go back is a very backward way, I think, of looking at it. It's not that I, you know, there's nothing, I don't think, in how I come off, you've read my site too, that is angry or I've opted out of normal society or I'm like trying to obstinately do something different. I just followed what interested me the most. And I'm grateful that it's something that has, you know, with the business sense that I had before, with the law degree I had, my love of writing, I always wrote. I would write if no one read. It's something I need to do. The fact that my words resonate with a growing number of people is an honor, right? And that those things, the confluence of those things together allow me to do this is not temporary. It is the new Jody. It is the new thing that I'm doing, you know? So I think it's very hard for someone taking that step to go into something new and think, well, people tell me that what I'm doing, being a lawyer, being an engineer, whatever it is good enough. And me feeling like it's not good enough, well, I'm the one who's got something wrong with me. I think it's actually the reverse, right? It's that a lot of people are not willing to entertain the not enoughness because it's a scary thing, and I respect that. But that there is so much more to the human experience than the jobs that we used to have, mostly because of technology. I couldn't do this if not for technology.
There's all these new possibilities out there.
Sure.
There's sort of a bias. There's a status quo bias of, well, there are professions or ways of doing things. And it takes a little bit of bravery to step outside of those and find what you'll discover. I like what you said about it being kind of your new normal. Something resonates with me because I get the sense that you float around quite a bit. I tend to go to a place and stay there for a few months at a time. But I have found that those experiences of allowing myself to really immerse myself in a different place, eventually that place becomes a part of me to the point where now I'm like probably going to be just moving to Colombia permanently for a much longer amount of time because, oh, now it's a part of me. It's a part of my life.
Yeah, I think there's two things there that are like wise to unpack for people who wanted to live this kind of lifestyle. One is that the idea of a home is a very moving target if you avail yourself of technology. So for me, you know, the psychology of knowing that I can walk into Saigon, for example, or Bangkok or a bunch of other cities and say, okay, within an hour, I can probably find at least a few apartments that I'm willing to live in. I can have a bowl of soup. I can hang out with a friend I haven't seen in a while. All those things being there for me are comforting enough that I don't need a specific home in the way that is traditionally required. Like you, you know, I do take a lot more time in places. At the beginning, when it was Jess and I, we were backpacking and I was not even traveling with a laptop. You know, it was the experience of travel. Now that it's become a business, I don't think it's accurate to say I travel all the time. I do, like you do, rent a place and stay and eat. And especially when you're looking at food, I think it's important to stay somewhere for a while because you really want to dig under the surface. The traditions, the history, the culture, you know, all those are really important. I actually just signed a year lease in Oaxaca, which I was not looking for an apartment. What happened was like a friend, a place across the way from her came up for rent and it was really reasonable. I loved the area and I was like, you know what? I'll rent it. It's a reasonable price. And then a reader wrote me and was like, hey, I'm looking for a place in Oaxaca. Do you know anywhere I can rent? And I said, well, actually, I'm currently housing myself in two apartments. I have these two leases, you know, if you want to take over for a few months. And so she's subletting that place. It worked out very well. But I'm going to come back here next winter as well, because the food history in Oaxaca is so deep and interesting. You know, just a few months this winter, the 5 months I'll be here is just not enough.
Yeah, I know what you mean about the sense of home being kind of a portable thing, or the feeling of so strange, you know, when I can just fly into Colombia and then, oh, okay, like I'm in another place where I'm comfortable and I know my way around, know
yeah,
how to get certain great things, and each time it's a little bit better.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think you may have, you probably have experienced this as well, that when you travel and when you put yourself in these situations that are challenging, inevitably you do run across some times where you might have a tough challenge or an existential crisis or something, and you realize you've got no choice.
You have to face
make
it.
Make your sense of home an internal thing.
Yeah, I think that's very, very well said. And like anything else in life, whether it's purchasing things like we talked about before, or you know, some of the decision making, like you have to live with yourself, right? And that, and there is something about travel that forces you to sort of confront and stew in your own suffering sometimes, in a way that I think makes you stronger if you're willing to do it. There's this sort of trope of you travel to run away, and I think that there are those people, right? But if you're doing this long term and you're building a life out of this curiosity. And I'm not just speaking about my choices, but a lot of the people I've met along the way, they're not doing it because they're running. They're doing it because it actually allows them this decadence of self-work that is more than they would get if they had a normal life. So I think you're very right about that. There's something about putting yourself in uncomfortable, unfamiliar places that that necessitates a sort of self-examination that I think does make you stronger.
Yeah, think of it like etching glass. It's like dipping yourself in this acid bath over and over again, where there's parts that are not that vulnerable to change because they're covered in wax, but these other parts that just get eaten away by yourself changes. And when you do that over and over again, you reach sublime clarity of yourself because your surroundings do influence the parts of you that are vulnerable to change.
For sure. I think there's a bit of a danger sometimes, though. You know, I had a reader write me recently, and he just started traveling, and he was just like, I really feel these connections to people and places, and like it's so much more than normal life. You know, there's this kind of danger of starry-eyed, this is better versus this is worse. And I just don't think, again, it's a very binary way of looking at it. And it's a danger because, you know, for example, two people who meet backpacking and then have this whirlwind romance, and then they go back to normal life and they're like, oh, we don't really like each other anymore. You know, there's something about the magic of that connection that, you know, is deeper, I think, when you're meeting people in strange places. Often it's because there's this commonality of both of you being fish out of water that requires a trust and a connection that supersedes small talk right away. And that allows you to build something more intense more quickly, be it, you know, people who meet while they're traveling or friends. You know, the friends I've got where, you know, we met somewhere, we eat lunch, we're like, what are you eating for dinner? And the next day, like, what are you eating for lunch? You know, you suddenly have a group of six people who spend pretty much every meal chatting and eating and then going back to work. The amount of hours you spend together far supersedes the normal, like, I'll see you this month, okay, like next month we'll hang out for dinner too. And so there is a deepening relationship, but I think it's also important for people not to expect that of everyone. You know, there's this disillusionment where people necessarily spend time somewhere and then they go back to where they came from and they're like, oh, people just aren't as interactive. And I'm like, you need to give them the benefit of the doubt here, because their lives don't have what your lives have in this constant, you know, intense conversation with a group of people.
Do you remember anything in particular about lawyering that you think were not suitable for personality?
I do really miss negotiating. I have to say, I loved negotiating. It was really fun. In a messed up way, like it's that high stakes stress where if I fell off a cliff tomorrow, you know, there'd be some people who'd be really sad. My family would be very, very sad, but you know, my readers would be like, oh, it's a shame. But I think the pressure of like, if I mess up, a $10 billion deal goes down the toilet was this kind of like really a honed in pressure that is different. I don't miss that necessarily, but it does drive you to perform as a human in ways you don't think you're capable of, it's also really bad for your immune system on a consistent basis. So I think for me, what didn't drive being a lawyer was that it was very much, there was room for a certain amount of creativity, but that was it. And anything outside that, you know, cardboard box was seen as a problem. People aren't necessarily or weren't looking for innovative thinkers in a classic, like really out there with great ideas way. They're looking for people who are innovative enough to take what's in that box and like rearrange it in a really interesting, innovative way, but not like to take the box, cut it down, and build a new box. And for me, I felt that very constricting. And I did a lot of pro bono work as a result of just trying to have something different to resonate. But, you know, looking back on it, it's hard to pinpoint at the time what it is that felt like drudgery. Part of it was the work. You know, when you're a junior associate, you're not doing the really exciting stuff. You're doing research briefs and you're doing due diligence and you're staying up all night waiting for the wires to hit. So the nature of the work doesn't really inure itself to creativity either.
Since you seem to kind of have enjoyed the negotiation part of things, have you been finding any ways to integrate that into your current lifestyle and business?
No, I haven't. I mean, I miss the negotiating in that it was very fast-paced and you have to be thinking on your feet. It wasn't the adversarial nature of it that I thought is currently lacking. It's more that it was like a challenge to be one step ahead and trying to think, okay, what's the person going to throw back? I do find things like what we're doing now, like podcasting, having conversations with interesting, smart people, you know, very fulfilling in a similar way where the back and forth is less adversarial, thankfully.
Yeah.
But equally, you know, it's sort of like the same part of my brain that is happy where it's just things I haven't thought about or ideas that are different. And, you know, I was chatting at a bar here in Oaxaca the other night with someone who is here for a month, and we were talking about different books we had read about neuroscience. And I was saying, you know, it's a good conversation when like you have a list on your phone of the books you need to get at the end or like articles you need to read. So I think that part of my life certainly has that triggered and in a good way. And that I'm grateful for the fact that this kind of meandering path I've taken has allowed me to make friendships and come into contact with some extremely bright, interesting people who are, you know, passionate about their work, but they have also a very flexible mentality. And I think that I'm curious to see where they go as well with their ideas.
So I guess the thinking on your feet aspect, that's sort of inherent in travel.
In travel, yeah. That's a fair point, yeah.
And I'm curious, did you check out any of those neuroscience books that were on your list?
I had read a lot as well, last year. After I did that Vipassana retreat course in New Zealand, I was like, okay, any person who tells me that a certain book changed their life, I commit to reading it. And so I read like a lot of really good books. I read a lot of really bad books. And I wrote a post actually summarized them all because I actually then asked my readers, like, what are the books that changed your lives? And someone said, can you just put this somewhere? And so I did this giant book post where people could then check out everyone else's books. But yeah, there were a lot of really interesting books on meditation and on fear and anxiety. And I think understanding what we're learning now about neuroplasticity and about what the brain is actually capable of and what you can do to change your brain is just fascinating stuff. I find it really interesting.
Any top recommendations?
After the course I did, I read The Antidote, which I really liked because it talks about, I think the subhead is like a book about happiness for people who hate positive thinking. And I was like, that's me. It's a really great book. And his point basically being like, if we obsess over finding happiness, like we're just as bad as people who are not trying to be happy. You know, you can't single-mindedly look for something and then claim that it just comes to you. And his focus was people need to just step back and like really try not to control as much. And he talks about Vipassana also in this whole idea of impermanence. I think reading Full Catastrophe Living was really important to my life because I have dealt with chronic pain for a really long time after a bad accident. And I've had really terrible back pain that kind of permeated a lot of my life because it was affecting pretty much everything I did. And that book talks about mindfulness and awareness and the way that your brain processes information. And I found it really useful and helpful also.
Did it say anything about kind of the perception of happiness? Because for me, I sort of take issue with the idea of happiness being the goal, just because of what it seems to be most people's definition of happiness. You know, I think elation, I get a sense, is what people think of as happiness. I would much rather be content, like just to not be miserable, you know?
Content has kind of a negative connotation, I think, these days, where like people are like, oh, I'm not happy in my relationship, I'm just content. And I think, I don't know if that's really
what could be better
right
than being content.
I know. I think, people want this high, you know, social media makes it worse, right? Because people are portraying a version of themselves online that may not be accurate. You just don't know. And so then there's this comparison game to something that may not be reality that then makes you feel worse about yourself. The whole comparison is the thief of joy thing is I think very, very accurate. I think the antidote does say that basically that this Western obsession with happiness is part of the problem. That the cultures that are truly happy and who have found what we would define as happiness in spite of very, very difficult situations or circumstances are happy because they're not holding this sort of overarching goal of it as their life's goal so much as they are seeking human connection and seeking joy from small experiences and letting go of the bigger things that they can't control. And that's something we do very badly at, especially in the West. I listened to, Pema Chodron has an audiobook called Getting Unstuck, and I listened to it a lot on the subways running around New York this summer. It was a good subway soundtrack. And she has this whole bit where she talks about how the Dalai Lama came to an event in the West and someone asked a question at the end being like, hi, I just want to understand, like, what do you do when you meditate and it's like a really bad session and you're really beating yourself up while you're meditating and you're not able to focus because you're too busy feeling like you're inadequate and all this stuff. And he was just like, I don't understand. He just didn't. He looked at the teachers who were there from like the Western meditation teachers, and he's like, what is she? I don't understand. And she was like, okay. And they're like, oh, this is really common here. We do this a lot. We beat ourselves up for things that are not our problem, really. And so she's like, okay, I have a better question then. Like, what is the worst thing that happened? Like, what's the thing that makes you feel terrible about something that you did? And he was like, well, this monk came to see me and he was 70 and he was older. He wanted to do these very aggressive yoga exercises. And I was like, no, you can't do that because you're too old. Like, do these yoga exercises instead. And so what did the monk do? He left and then he killed himself because in his belief system, he would come back again as a younger person able to do the exercises. And everyone in the audience was like aghast, of course. Mm-hmm. And she's like, okay, like, so how did that make you feel? And he's like, I felt terrible. I felt awful. It was my fault. I should have thought more. I felt like I counseled him wrongly and all this stuff. And she was like, okay, so when did you stop feeling that way? And he stopped and he didn't say anything and he thought about it. And then he goes, you know what? It's never gone away. I just don't let it drag me down. And I was like, and that's our problem. We let it drag us down, right? Yeah.
This is one of the things I really like about, I don't want to generalize to Latin called Colombian. You might hear the response from somebody, estoy contento, I'm content. And that's like a good thing, which there might be something being lost in translation, but I don't think so. Like, it's seen as a good thing. Is it like that in Mexico at all? Do you ever hear people say that? Estoy contento?
No, they don't. They say todo bien, or they'll say like, estoy feliz, I'm happy.
Yeah.
No, but I think that there is a kind of undercurrent of joviality that comes with what you see here or in other developing countries where, if we can't control it, then we shrug our shoulders and we're like, well, we can't control it. And there is a lot that's bad there too, right? With those things that, there's kind of an apathy that is there for good reason, where there's often a dictator who is in power, or it's come from places that are very valid, but it often means that the things that we agonize over traditionally in the West are things that are less agonizing in places like Mexico or Colombia or Vietnam, for example, which a lot of Westerners find very horrifying. The way there is, there is just a very different perspective on what being happy means, what's enough, like what's important. And I think that's part of why food is so relevant to what I do. It's because it's so universal and it's such a binding, cohesive thing that it brings cultures and people together in all these countries in ways that our very young countries just don't have. So I was eating breakfast today, having quesadillas on the at a market, and like the women next to me are eating quesadillas, and they're talking about is food. Oh yeah, I made this chicken, and I did this, and like food is just so important to so many of these cultures. I think there is a lack of community in some ways that informs our obsession with individual happiness in Western countries. You know, you see that stark difference, I'm sure, in Colombia also, where events that involve food are like big events where there's tons of people, everyone's sharing. The kind of, we don't share our meals, everything's very individual. Yes, we have barbecues at home, right, and events like that, but there's sort of like this expectation of community that is different, I think, in places that we've traveled to.
Yeah, I noticed that, and I've also noticed, I think there was something you said kind of about things working, or I don't know if I'm getting that right, or maybe I'm projecting my own thoughts onto what you said, but I've just noticed whenever I come here, the first couple months as an adjustment, I might be a little impatient.
Right.
Things work 87% of the time in the United States. In Colombia, they work like 53% of the time. And it's enough to just really annoy me at first. But then eventually I learned that, well, nobody has the expectation that everything's just going to work all the time.
So right. Problem is expectation, right? It's the problem with happiness too. People have an expectation. They deserve a specific level of happiness. And it's that, and I'm not saying walk around not expecting anything, but like you have to be realistic and adjust your expectations. You know, when you go to Colombia, you know that things that are working back in North America won't work here. And then you're going to get all sorts of benefits that are different also. The apartment I rented here, you know, the sink won't stop running. I have figured out a way to like gently turn the tap to stop it, but the key underneath won't shut off the water. You know, it's day three of waiting for the plumber, and that's just how it is. You know, everyone's like, oh God, plumbers in here. My landlord's like, well, it's a plumber. And I was like, is this just a universally problematic profession here? And he's like, well, kind of. But at the same time, he's like, oh, you read about food, hold on. And then calls his friend in a village, like outside in the Oaxaca Valley, and was like, what's the name of that chef in your village? Like, can you get her name? I have this lady here who likes food. Let's bring her out there. You know, there's this kind of willingness to put yourself out there in some ways. And then in other ways that you would expect efficiency back home, that's just not happening. And if you throw it a tantrum about it, you're just hurting yourself, you know?
Lately, it's been fingerprint entry, like my building or my gym or something, which that sounds like high-tech stuff, but it's here in Colombia and it never works. I'm always having to re-enter my finger. It's kind of funny. I guess it's like if you live in the United States and you have a 100% expectation and work 87% of the time versus if you live in Colombia and you have an expectation of things just not working most of the time, and then they work 53% of the time, then, wow, you're happier, more of a, you've exceeded your expectation.
Right. I mean, it's a tough one because you don't want to just have zero expectations all the time. That would lead to like a very negative mindset also. Sure. But it's being realistic. And I think that's part of what the antidote the book talks about is just being realistic about what your capacity for happiness and connection is in whatever given circumstance you're in. And I think, you know, in the case of what you're talking about, part of it is a purchasing power problem or a money issue where the standard of living and the cost of living is very different. And that comes with different things. The cost of my rent here is a lot less than what it would cost me in Montreal. And the landlords here don't, you know, have the same expectations of what they're supposed to do either. That's just stuff you have to navigate, and it teaches you something. And if you approach it without anger, I think you get a lot further. I see travelers often like really losing their shit over something that is just not fixable or changeable. And in a culture, let's say like Thailand, where if you publicly make someone lose face, or Vietnam, or you know, you're never going to get what you want, because that's just you've humiliated them culturally in front of people they know, and that's just not how it works. Mm-hmm. Just patience, like you said, patience.
What's the biggest compromise that you've had to make to get where you are?
Compromise or sacrifice?
Am I misunderstanding the definition of compromise?
No, I'm just... I understand
you're a lawyer and you use language very precisely. But
no, I'm just thinking of like compromise as in with myself, like a middle ground with myself for my lifestyle.
Yeah, I'm sure there's probably been times when it's difficult to make a decision in one way and you couldn't have both things at once. And
right.
You had to...
I mean, I think the hardest thing is partly that being transient means your relationships are transient too. Like your friendships, it's fixable. But, you know, part of the conversation I was having yesterday was how there's occasionally a mentality with people who choose this life that they're like weak if they rearrange their plans for someone else. And I'm not talking about like dating relationships. I just mean in general that there's this idea like, well, I'm then not dovetailing with my exact end goals. And that kind of flexibility I talked about earlier is important here too. You know, friends and I all arranged to come to Oaxaca in February for the month so that we could spend time in the same place. And there were like a group of 15 of us in total at that time. You know, everyone had to make sure they changed their schedules to do it, but no one was like, well, you know, you should all come to where I want to go. It's, if one person has a stronger opinion about where they want to be, like I'm super happy to change my plans to be with a friend that I really jive with or care about and enjoy their company. I think, you know, that is hard because a lot of people don't have that mentality, and therefore you then like often don't get to see people that you'd want to spend time with. There's no consistency of community in a way there is with people who have very set and more sedentary lives. I think health is the other thing that's quite difficult. You know, I have an autoimmune disease. When I get sick, I get sicker than most people as a result. My immune system is already a mess. You know, I got dengue in Vietnam, and I have to deal with, you know, all the other things that may come from a messed up immune system. Like when I get the flu, it's not a week, it's usually longer. That's hard, you know, when you're traveling and you need to really build in the time and the energy and like the infrastructure, for me personally, at least, to know that I will have a way to get treatment or to be around people if I need help to help.
Yeah. And as far as the story about relationships being transient, I know there was a friend the other day that I invited to dinner and mm-hmm. then just on Messenger. And then the night of the dinner, he was like, oh, what? I thought you were going to send like a Facebook invite or something, because usually everything with the sort of expat transient community is like everybody's invited and there's a different expectation of what it means to commit to dinner plans or things.
That's interesting. I guess it depends on the community as well. Like Fridays are goat days for me in Oaxaca because there's a person that comes in to an only Friday market and they serve like barbacoa chiva. A goat like cooked in the with avocado leaves and really beautiful tacos that they make, or consomme soup. And so, you know, usually we go to 11 and I was like, guys, we're gonna have to move goat to 3:30 because I have a podcast that I'm recording. So like goat o'clock is now 3:30 p.m. my time.
You changed goat time to talk to me, is that?
Yeah, that's what
happened. Oh wow.
But my point is that, you know, it's a really informal thing that everyone knew in town. There's two new people who came in the last bit. And I was like, so Fridays are goat days. And, you know, you're just going to have to come eat some goat with us at 11, except this week it's at 3:30. So people just come. I think part of what I've enjoyed is the informality of it. So the Facebook invites are definitely not, like, I definitely work more on the, I'll just send you a quick text and we'll meet, than a formal invitation.
I'm always interested to, you know, when people have decided to leave money on the table and what it was they got in exchange for it. I think it's a really, it's a good way to see what somebody values. So can you think of a time when you, I mean, I can think of very obvious ones, if you think of a time when you left money on the table and what did you get in exchange for that?
I mean, I think I've done that consistently from the very beginning with the site, right? I've turned down really lucrative sponsorship opportunities back when, you know, travel bloggers were relying on shitty text links and non-disclosed posts that were like going up hidden from their RSS. Like I never did any of that because I was like, I didn't quit my job to build something that makes me feel like I don't have integrity. And that's a personal decision, right? What other people have different reasons for doing those things. The money to them is more important. That's fine. Everyone makes their personal decisions. To me, I wanted to build something that my readers would be people who are reading things that I would want to read. And I do talks where I'm like, if you would take a quick $300 over building a sustainable business, then you should leave the talk right now, because this is just not what we're here to talk about. And, you know, it's really, really easy to make really terrible money. but in the long run, I think that's not what's important. What's important is maintaining the integrity of your reputation, both online and off. My readers know that if I link to something, guaranteed, it's something I believe in. And if I'm paid to be linking to it in some way, like with the G Adventure stuff. Every time I talk about G, I always say I'm a brand ambassador. I'm not throwing it in without mentioning it, because it's really important that they understand the relationships I have are legitimate ones, and that it I would have made a lot more money had I taken a different perspective, but I'm very happy with the way I did it instead.
You've mentioned one book with the anecdote, and I promise you is a canned question that is not related to the question that you were asking people after your retreat. What was the last book you read that changed the way you saw something?
Changed the way I saw the world, you think? Like the way
something,
that I...
Anything. Well, somebody once suggested a book about ants.
God, I read an amazing book about rats, actually. That wasn't the last book I read. I feel like I've read a lot of books that have changed things. Like I've read Flow and some of the books this year, like The Antidote, were very new to me because I'd never meditated before I did the Vipassana. I had never explored things like, you know, what your brain is capable of. It's just not the type of information that I had looked at before. So all of that was really new. I think an important book for people to read generally that definitely changed the way I perceive conversation is a book called Difficult Conversations, which a lot of lawyers are recommended to read, you know, and it's proven to be something that is really useful in approaching conversations that are hard with empathy, with compassion. And even if you're not someone who can naturally put yourself in someone else's shoes, the book helps you like maintain kind of a stability when emotions run away from you, that allows you to come to a much better conclusion when you're having conversations that are tough. I think everyone and their mother should read that book. It's extremely, extremely important. I do love single purpose micro histories. So the book about rats, for example, that I read, was about how rats came to New York City and like how originally we call them, Norwegian rats, the black rats that are no longer there, but actually they were from German mercenaries. The rats that are there now came on the German ships when they were pulled in, when the British still controlled the island. Like just really interesting way of looking at it, and talked about how when 9/11 happened, and the towers fell, there were all the food underneath the towers and they were like millions of rats procreating and eating. And some of them had tested positive for the plague. And so they were like bait and trapping and poisoning Lower Manhattan, but they were afraid to talk about it because it would have been like a pandemonium. Just a fascinating book.
Wow,
by someone
fascinating,
and like sat on a stool in Eden Alley in downtown New York City, just like watching rats every night for a while, and then wrote about it, and then was like, I'm going to go to a rat conference, and I'm going to meet the exterminator of New York City, and then 9/11 happened as he was sitting there, and so he wove that into his book, and in a way that I think was very classy and not at all using it to leverage his position, unlike some books out there for sure. I love the book. I love Salt and Cod by Mark Kurlansky, talking about, you know, how things like salt change the world. There's a book called Spice. Yeah, just how, you know, you couldn't have had boats explore the new world without something to sustain them, like salted cod. The idea of curing things with salt.
No, it just reminded me. I used to love to watch Modern Marvels on History Channel, and I believe there was probably a salt episode.
For sure. Yeah, those kinds of like taking something small and using it as a lens to change the way you think of like bigger world history events are super interesting. So Jack Turner has a book called A History of Temptation, which is about spices, you know, and he has like the first few chapters are hilariously, he just hates Christopher Columbus, who like by all accounts was just not a great dude. And he's talking about how, like, until he died, he still thought he had found, like, he's like, you did not find a route to spices. But he talks about things like peppercorn, which were paid taxes, paid rent for so many years. And now, of course, we buy them everywhere. Here in Mexico, chocolate is a really important thing. And they used to pay rent in cacao beans, you know. And now that, too, is super cheap and common. It's a very similar thing where, you know, in History of Temptation, Jack Turner talks about how people, part of it was like very religious. People thought that the Garden of Eden had all the spices in paradise, and therefore finding the route to spices would also guarantee them like heaven in a way when they passed away. And in the ancient, you know, pre-Hispanic texts, it talks about chocolate here in this region, in Mesoamerica, as being the food of the gods and being a really important and powerful thing. So the correlation between those two stories is really interesting.
It's interesting about the currency. Laura Roeder, who I think you know, recommended debt. The first 5,000. There's a lot in there about
And
what
money.
Did it mean to owe somebody something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a very different way than how we treat it now, right?
Do you make your bed?
I do, but not right away. I always get out of bed and then I like crawl toward coffee, and then after my coffee, I go back and make the bed.
Ah, okay.
Modified bed making. I don't know.
Have you always made your bed? Conscious decision?
Oh no, I'm very bad with like the I'm going to do these habits and they're going to be part of my life. I'm not very good at those things at all, because I just never think of making them habits. I just do something I want to do. Really, I was forced to make my bed as a kid a lot, and then when I moved out to go to law school, I think I did make it. Only because it's more of like, what does the value proposition offer, right? Making your bed takes 2 seconds, but it makes you feel so much more tidy that it's like, why not make your bed?
Yeah, I guess I could say forced to make my bed as a kid. I probably protested and do it. And then I definitely didn't do it for a very long time. And just recently in the last couple of years, finally made a habit of it. And for me, it is kind of one of those habits of like, oh, if I'm traveling, it gives me a sense of home in a way. But also, yeah, I find it makes my brain work a little bit better. I have to say, though, a very low percentage of the guests make their beds.
Is that so?
I was really shocked by that. I guess Jason Fried gave me a tip that, I don't know if it was a tip, but it made me think about making my bed a little bit differently. Throws it, because at first I would just put the sheets, tuck them under. And actually, the thing is, I actually hate that. I hate having my feet restricted. I've got to kick it out, then I finally get back in the bed. I don't do that anymore. I make it look neat.
Yeah, that's what I do too. It's not very formal. I just like throw my covers up over it. I don't like, I don't understand the people who have, you know, a million sham pillows and like all these weird pillows on their bed. I have a family member, when I visit them, I have to like legitimately just take like 8 armfuls of pillows and put them in the closet.
Just throw them on the floor and, you know, it causes more of a mess.
Complicated. Yeah, I'm not. I just want a nice, like, simple, comfy bedspread and, like, a pillow or two.
I feel the same way about the sham pillows. However, I do appreciate them quite a bit. Like, when I see a bed that's got sham pillows all over, I'm like, ooh, that looks... Do you have a final message for our listeners out there who are looking to carve out their own definition of success?
I think that, you know, whatever you decide to do, you need to think more about skills than you do about passion. Cal Newport talks about how, you know, it's important to build a skill set that you get really strong at and then leverage that to build the life you want. And that's always been my perspective and my belief as well. You know, it puts a lot of pressure on people to be like, what are you passionate about? Do that. And then it'll all happen perfectly. That's just not very realistic. I think a better option is truly to, like I said, when we talked about worst case scenario, to think about the kinds of things that you uniquely have as a skill set. Like, what has in your life led you to where you are? What's the background that you have? You know, there's a book called The Gift of Fear, and the guy who wrote it, he works in, you know, really an agency that profiles stalkers and a lot of the crimes against predominantly women, but men too. You know, he had a really abusive, really horrific childhood. And he says in his book, you know, this is part of what allows me to have worked this way. I took this and I used it to fuel my desire to prevent other people from being in this place. So for me, it's the same with the celiac cards or whatever it is. There's something, no doubt, in each person's background and life that is something that's unique to them. And then that combined with the skill sets that you can learn, then you can build something really interesting. But coming at it from a perspective of like, what am I passionate about or how can I scale or something a lot more logical, I think kind of blinds you to what you're truly capable of. Those things are very important later down the line and when you're building out your business. But I think when you're talking about what the subject is, you need to look inside first and think about the kinds of things that you are able to talk about with integrity and then figure out like how those match with what people need in the marketplace.
Yeah, and in a way, your valleys are those things that challenge, perhaps even wounds can be your greatest sources of power.
Definitely.
And where can people find more of you?
So my site is legalnomads.com, and on Instagram, on Facebook, on Twitter, it's also legalnomads. Very simple. those posters we talked about with food maps are just shop.legalnomads.com. And I'll be adding Portugal. I've got Thailand, Vietnam, and Mexico, and Portugal's the next one. My artist was, we had to put Madeira, Porto Santo, all the little islands from the Azores. So I promised Italy would be next, so she would have a very simple boot and not these little islands to draw in there as well. Mm-hmm. But yeah, Legal Nomads is pretty much where I am online, and I answer my own reader questions myself on my emails. So if people have questions, feel free to reach out.
Thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me today. It's been a great conversation. I think it'll be very helpful and inspirational for a lot of the listeners, and I hope that you enjoy your goat.
Thank you. I'm sure I will. Thanks for having me, David. Yeah.
So, there we have it. Before I go, I gotta ask, do you like books? If you do, I'd love to send you my book recommendations. About 90% of them will be nonfiction on subjects spanning from biographies to neuroscience. Just go to cadavy.net/reading, sign up, and you'll get my first set of recommendations right away. You'll be supporting the show if you buy any of those books through the links in the email. This has been Love Your Work, and I'm David Cadavy. The theme music for this show is CNU, performed by The Album Leaf, courtesy of Sub Pop Records. Love Your Work is a production of Cadavy Inc.